It's time to wake up. Stay tuned for Free Thought Radio, the only weekly Free Thought Radio broadcast anywhere. A production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation featuring co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Hello, all you godless heathens. It's time to wake up. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome the next hour of Free Thought Radio, the only weekly Free Thought Radio broadcast in the nation. We're broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin. Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a national association, the largest association of atheists and agnostics working to defend the constitutional principle of the separation of church and state. And we do invite you to curl up with a cup of coffee and stay tuned for the next hour.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. We have a real special interview today in just a few minutes from across the Atlantic. We'll be talking with atheism and science's most distinguished advocate, Professor Richard Dawkins, an author and a promoter of reason. We'll be calling him at his office in Oxford in just a few minutes. But first, Annie Laurie always wants me to tell a joke, and the first joke I told at the first Freedom From Religion Foundation convention was this one. St. Peter was at the pearly gates, and Jesus comes up to him and says, "Pete, you look kind of low today." And Peter said, "Yeah, I think I'm getting the flu." And Jesus says, "Well, why don't you, it's Friday afternoon, why don't you take the rest of the day off and I'll cover for you. It's kind of slow, you know." So Peter leaves, goes wherever he goes, and Jesus sits there at the pearly gates, and it is really slow. And just about quitting time, there's this feeble knock at the door, and Jesus opens the door or the gate, and there's this old withered man standing there. And Jesus says, "Welcome to heaven. What is your name, sir?" And the guy says, "My name? I'm so old, I don't remember my name." And Jesus said, "Well, we can't just let anybody in here. We got to know who you are. I mean, can you tell us something about yourself?" And he said, "Well, I think I have Alzheimer's. I don't know. I can't remember. Oh, I do remember I had a son." And Jesus said, "Oh, that's a start. Well, what do you know about your son?" "Well, he went away from me, and he had nails in his hands, and he had nails in his feet. And he came back to me," and Jesus looked at the man and said, "Father?" And the old man looked at Jesus and said, "Pinocchio?"
It's a classic. For today's pop disbelief quiz, quickly let's test your knowledge, and here's the question. By an act of Congress, U.S. currency has carried the motto, "In God We Trust," since, and here's your four possibilities, A, the very beginning, B, 1862, C, 1914, or D, 1957. And I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. We're going to go right to our interview with Professor Dawkins by phone in Oxford. And afterward, we have a little scoop for you for Free Thought Radio and 92.1 FM. We are going to, for the first time in the United States, broadcast excerpts from Richard Dawkins' Channel 4 United Kingdom series, The Root of All Evil, about religion. It has never been broadcast before in the United States. It hasn't been on TV. And we have some audio that we'll be playing at the end of the interview.
I'm Dan Barker with Free Thought Radio with my co-host, Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we have a wonderful interview today. One of our heroes, for many reasons, Professor Richard Dawkins, is on the line from Oxford, England. This is our first transatlantic interview, I think. Professor Richard Dawkins was born in Nairobi, and he's a British citizen. They moved to England when he was a child. He graduated from Oxford University, where he got his doctorate. He's taught at the University of California in Berkeley and lectured in zoology at Oxford University. He is currently the newly endowed holder of the newly endowed Charles Simonyi Chair of the Public Understanding of Science. He was elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. He's married to an actress and an artist, Lala Ward, who has illustrated a couple of his books. His book, The Selfish Gene, was an immediate bestseller where he debunks the idea that evolution is about us. It's about the genes, really. And his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was one of my favorites, has been translated into all major languages, came out in 1986, followed by The Extended Phenotype, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, and he has been called by some the Devil's Chaplain, and he has a book called The Devil's Chaplain. He's won both the Royal Society of Literature Award and the LA Times Literary Prize for The Blind Watchmaker. And he's won the Silver Medal of the Zoological Society of London, many other awards, the Honorary Doctor of Literature by the University of St. Andrews. He was the Humanist of the Year in 1996, and since then has been Vice President of the British Humanist Association. And he's also won the coveted Emperor Has No Clothes Award in 2001, awarded by the Freedom From Religion Foundation to public figures for plain speaking about the problems of religion. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's also on the advisory board of the Secular Coalition for America, of which our foundation is a member, working for a secular government. And his new book, which we've had the pleasure to read a proof copy of, is called The God Delusion. Richard, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much. Can I just update your wonderful list of things?
Oh, of course.
You said Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. I'm rather more proud of Fellow of the Royal Society.
Yes.
although it is quite nice to have both a scientific and a literary fellowship.
Yes, and you are attacking on all fronts. Your books in science, really, The Blind Watchmaker, which demolishes creationism, which I read when it first came out. And yet you're going beyond that into philosophy and into criticism of religion, especially with your new book. Annie Laurie is holding an article there that came out in Newsweek, was it, last week?
Yes, did you see the article about you in Newsweek?
Yes.
The new naysayers.
I did see that.
And I wanted you to have a chance to say something about that article. You know, it was actually very good publicity considering the source. But it takes pot shots at atheists like you for being fundamentalists when it comes to the Bible. And you're really one of the most outspoken atheists in the world today. And I thought you might like a chance to rebut that.
I'd forgotten that the Newsweek article said that. The Newsweek article actually had a very good effect on sales. The book is not yet out in America, or not officially anyway. But the Newsweek article did have a big effect on advance sales on Amazon, and then even more of an effect on Sam Harris's new book, Letter to a Christian Nation. And both our books were given a great boost by that Newsweek article.
Well, we had him on last week.
Good, I'm very glad
and
to hear
it. And he complained that those caricatures of you guys make you look like Dracula or something. You saw them, you know?
Yes. Anyway, I don't remember what it said about...
Well, it was saying that atheists are guilty of being fundamentalists about the Bible.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, fundamentalism, I think, means belief in a holy book unswervingly. And so no scientist is a fundamentalist. I don't understand what it would mean to say that an atheist was a fundamentalist about the Bible.
Well, because we take it to mean what it says, and therefore we're to be criticized because we're not moderate. You know, if we say that the Bible promotes slavery.
Okay, then... I see. Okay. Well, two things about that. One, an extremely alarming number of the American population does take it literally.
Yes.
And so we have to take that seriously. But what was the other thing? It'll come back to me what the other thing I was going to say about that was.
No, The God Delusion, you have a very ringing, many ringing sentences, but there's one in particular where you say the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Could
all
you elaborate?
Fiction. Yes, that's right. That's right. And I remembered what the other thing was I was going to say. it's all very well saying that moderates don't take the Bible seriously anymore, only fundamentalists do. But there has to be some way in which the moderates decide which bits of the Bible they do take seriously and which bits they don't. So if you talk to a progressive bishop, he might say something like, well, of course, we don't believe in the book of Genesis. Nobody but a fool would believe in the book of Genesis. But we do believe that Jesus rose on the third day. So I always want to say about that, well, how do you decide? How do you decide to discriminate against Genesis and in favor of the New Testament?
Well, it's because that's an easier miracle for God to do, apparently, raising a dead man. You know?
Yes, so, okay.
I suppose, yeah. If I were God, it would be hard to create a universe, but I could raise somebody from the dead.
Now, I think the purpose of the God delusion is, you state in your preface that you'd really like someone who's reading it, if they're not an atheist already, to be an atheist by the time they're through reading your book.
Yeah, pretty forlorn hope, I suppose, but one wants to aim high.
But so you take people by the hand and you go through all the different arguments for God and religion and the Bible.
Yes.
And then you end it with, you know, talking about how ethics, you can have ethics without God. And I think the chapter that I like the best is chapter 8, What's Wrong with Religion, Why Be So Hostile, which really gets to the whole point of your book.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, one reason for being hostile, I think, is that as a scientist, it's very apparent that religion is an alternative worldview, which is a competitor for scientific truth, and that it teaches people to think in an unscientific way about subjects that really require a scientific method of thought. And this it shows itself in particular in my own field of evolution, where that science, that basic science, which is fundamental to the whole of biology, is actively subverted in American schools. So that's one reason to be hostile. Another reason to be hostile is that religion teaches blind faith, which means that you are right and the other person is wrong, and you don't have to justify it, you don't have to argue your position, you don't have to explain why you're right and they're wrong, you don't have to give any evidence, any supporting data, anything like that. It is just faith, and we all have to respect that, whether we are believers or not. We've been brainwashed by our society into believing that religion somehow deserves special respect. Faith deserves special respect. And it's almost impolite to question somebody's faith. You can question their politics or their economics or anything else, but the one thing you can't question is their faith. And I think that's got to stop. I think we see the fruits of faith all around the world now. We see on the one hand, in the Islamic world, people who are driven by their faith to kill, to behead, to torture, to suicide bombs. They believe that if they die a martyr's death, they're going straight to paradise, and so are all their relations. It's a very, very tempting target.
Well, then on 9/11, you know, you commented on the religious connections between the terrorist act. And 4 days after 9/11, on September the 15th, you had an article in The Guardian called "It's Time to Stand Up," really pointing a finger at religion as the basic problem.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's such a powerful motive. There are of course other motives for going to war, and religion probably wasn't a motive, say, in the First World War or the Second World War. So there are other motives, but it's a very, very powerful motive. If you think that you're the God that you've worshipped ever since your madrasa school is calling you to go and fight the infidel, if your holy book tells you that all infidels deserve death, then that is a very powerful motive. And that's on the Islamic side. But conversely, on the American side, the side that I call the American Taliban, the Christian fascists who are rapidly trying to take over the country at the moment, there's a substantial number of them who believe that Armageddon, which they long for, is nuclear war. They long for nuclear war because nuclear war will presage the second coming of Christ. So on the one hand, we've got Christians who think that. On the other hand, we've got Muslims who think that a martyr's death is the fast track to paradise. It's a poor lookout for the world.
Well, yes, and then I wondered if you had some comments about the Pope and his recent foot in the mouth about the Islam religion and then their reaction.
Yes, well, I think that the Pope got it right. I mean, when he was talking about Islam, he's certainly right that there is a fundamental incompatibility and a very dangerous incompatibility between Islam and Christianity. But if you read the rest of his speech, what he didn't get right is that there is also a fundamental divide between faith on the one, all faiths on the one hand, and scientific rationality on the other.
Well, and then he talked about how Muhammad wanted to spread faith by the sword, and that's in the Quran.
Yes.
But it's also in the New Testament that Jesus said, "I came not to bring peace, but a sword." So we sort of had a person in a glass house throwing a stone.
Yeah, who is he? His church who started the Crusades, you know, who is he to lecture them about violence?
Yes, that's right.
But it is scary to see this escalate.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the Pope could fairly retort that that although historically Christianity was spread by the sword, only Islam is spread by the sword now and still aspires to be. I mean, they still actually do want to take over the world.
And you were right about this Armageddon thing. When I used to be a fundamentalist preacher years ago, and that's exactly how I thought. This world, this natural world we live in, is not important. It's another world we're aiming for, so who cares what we do to our environment? Who cares what happens to the war? Who cares about human suffering now because there will be glory? And you're right. The way I used to think, and many of these right-wingers think, they revel in this idea of a bloodbath and the end of the world, and that's scary.
Yes, it is extremely scary.
Now, you've kind of coined another phrase. You refer to faith heads.
Oh, yes.
Which I like.
Yes, okay. I guess that comes from what sort of acid heads and things like that. It is very much like a drugged state. Sometimes you see pictures of these fanatical Muslims especially, but Christians too, with kind of wild staring eyes, totally taken over by the virus of faith and prepared to do anything, to kill, to die. It is a very, very dangerous state of mental illness.
So you think it is like a virus? Like, you know, alcoholism isn't really a virus, but it's a mind disorder. So religion can have that same kind of, you know, like somebody who's bulimic. You know, they can't control themselves, and religion can do that to your brain where you just walk around in a daze.
Yes, and unlike alcohol, well, I think unlike alcohol, it's more infectious. I mean, you do get infected with religion, usually as a young child, and then if you're unlucky, it stays with you for the rest of your life. But you can also be infected by a very charismatic preacher. I mean, a kind of Billy Graham type who you go to a rally and get infected there.
Well, maybe we can infect people with reason, you know. Maybe that's what your new book can do.
Of course, that's the aim. That's what we're all trying to do. It's superficially not necessarily such an attractive thing to infect people with, but I think it can be made attractive, and that's one of the things, not just in this book, but in all my books I've tried to do.
I remember your 1986 book, The Blind Watchmaker. Just as I had come out of religion, one of your sentences in there really hit me between the eyes, right in the middle of the book. You said, "Of course, any God capable of intelligently designing something as complex as the DNA protein replicating machine must have been at least as complex and organized as that machine itself."
Yes.
And that's just a sentence in the middle of a paragraph that it infected my thinking back then, and I'm sure your writings and your works and your preaching for reason have done some of that. We're helping to undo the virus of religion.
I'm terribly encouraged that you should say that about that one sentence, because in effect that is the, I mean, that one sentence is expanded into a whole chapter in The God Delusion.
Yes,
chapter four.
The Boeing 747.
It is the key chapter, and I think it's a totally unanswerable point. I don't claim it for myself, but I think it's a totally unanswerable point. I've never met anybody who gave an adequate answer to it. And it's particularly good because it, as it were, takes the weapon of actually the creationists and turns it on themselves, because their greatest weapon is the argument from improbability. They love doing statistical calculations of the improbability of something like an eye or a hemoglobin molecule or a bacterial flagellum. And of course, those things are statistically improbable. That's the very thing that any decent theory of life has got to do, is to explain how something as improbable as that comes into being. And so the one theory that can't possibly explain it is a God, because the God would have to be as improbable. The only kind of theory that can explain it is something like Darwinian natural selection, which is what Dan Dennett calls a crane. It starts from small beginnings and it builds up by slow, gradual degrees. That's the only way you're ever going to explain improbable complexity in the world.
Well, we'll be right back. We have to take a little break, and we hope you can stay on the line, Professor Dawkins.
Thank you.
We'll talk about the virus of religion and one of your pet peeves about the manipulation of children and religion.
I'm Dan Barker with Free Thought Radio with my co-host, Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and we are continuing our enlightening interview with professor and author Richard Dawkins. I think you were the person who coined the word meme, isn't that true?
Yes.
And that word has sort of, that meme, that word has become a meme of its own in society. It's sort of spread.
Yes. I mean, it's a kind of cultural virus. I wasn't really wanting to advocate it as a theory of how culture actually does work, but because it came at the end of The Selfish Gene, which was all about the importance of the gene in evolution, and I just wanted to make the point that the gene is not the only kind of self-replicating information that you can imagine. What Darwinism demands, the theory of Darwinian selection demands, is some kind of self-copying information, and there could be other kinds of self-copying information. Computer viruses would be another good example, which I didn't know about in 1976. So I coined memes instead, which are rather like computer viruses, but spread through human culture. And I used religion as one of the main examples.
As an infectious meme.
Yes.
That parents teach their children and society promotes.
Yes.
And that's how it's replicated.
Yes.
Well, it's a very enlightening way to look at religion.
And you also rail against people who identify children as, you know, that's a Muslim child and that's a Jewish child. And
That is a particular bee in my bonnet. I really, really think it's evil to label children. It's okay to label a children a boy or a girl because there really is a difference between a boy and a girl, and they have it at birth. But to label children as a Catholic child or a Protestant child or a Muslim child or a Jewish child, as though they were capable of having the sorts of opinions that go with being a religion. I mean, a Muslim baby or a Christian baby, a baptized child is a Christian child. That is such an evil piece of child abuse because it is thrusting onto that child a whole baggage of opinions, which when the child is grown up, it may or may not wish to hold. That is not a Christian child. That is a child of Christian parents.
Yeah, but I remember thinking in a Christian family, well, this must be part of who I am. You see, Jewish kids think their Jewish identity is very important to who they are as distinct from the rest of the world. And that's sort of a self-replicating idea, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, and of course, there are strong aspects of that. I mean, the language that a child speaks is normally the language of its parents, and that is an important part of its identity. The customs, the clothes that a child wears, these are all handed down from the parents, and that, I suppose, is unavoidable. But if religion just were a whole set of rather quaint traditions, like how you wear your hair and how you wear your clothes, etc., then I suppose it would be moderately innocent. But it isn't. It's a whole set of opinions about the universe, opinions about morality, opinions about humanity, which are not to be thrust upon a child in the same way as something like clothes fashions or something harmless and innocent like that.
And these are concepts that small children can't possibly grasp, which I think is where you get into this idea of abuse.
Well, that's right. I mean, people usually get the point when I make the point that nobody would ever talk about a Keynesian child or a Marxist child or a monetarist child. These are concepts which are adult concepts. Adult economists can be described as monetarist or Marxist or Keynesian. But a child of a Keynesian economist is not a Keynesian child. A child of a Marxist economist is not a Marxist child, and a child of a Christian is not a Christian child.
And this is another argument that comes up in the United Kingdom, where you have faith-based schools segregated by religion.
Yes.
That taxpayers are paying for.
That's right. I presume there are faith-based schools in America too, but they're not paid for by taxpayers'
money. Well, in three instances they are, and of course it's a big movement, so it's something we're fighting very much.
Well, in Britain they're very common, and some of them go back a long way. I mean, the Church of England, the Anglican Church, has had schools for a long time. They're actually mostly pretty innocuous, because they, although they are Anglican foundations, they don't, on the whole, indoctrinate in a very insidious way.
We saw some of the Muslim girls at that play.
Philip Pullman's play
about God,
The Dark Materials in London.
They were all sitting in the with their little outfits on, listening to this atheistic play, which we thought was pretty wonderful. Their school took them to this place.
Good. I mean, how old were they?
Oh,
grade school.
Yeah,
late grade school.
I don't know what that is.
In London,
probably. 10 to 12.
Okay.
In their ages.
But
I didn't see that picture. That's nice.
Well, it's a very nice thing for children to see.
Yeah. I mean, what's happened is that because there have been Anglican schools and Catholic schools for quite a long time, the Muslims have now said, well, to be fair, we ought to have our faith schools, and they've got a point. But what the government ought to say is, right, we're going to have no faith schools at all.
Exactly.
Instead of which they've said, oh, well, to be fair, we've got to have Muslim schools as well. And so we've got this awful divisiveness.
Yes.
And it's been around in Northern Ireland a long time. I mean, the Northern Ireland Troubles would disappear in a generation if there were not Catholic schools and Protestant schools teaching generation after generation of children the same bigotry as their parents were taught.
To hate each other, or that they're not the right religion.
A totally different view of history.
It's so divisive. Religion is such a
very,
divisive.
Very, very divisive.
Well, that's why they want to identify this is a Jewish child, this is a Christian child, this is a Muslim child, in order to deliberately be divisive. We are set apart. We are better. We are chosen. We are elect. We are saved in some way from the others. I want to get back to what you said about improbability, which is really a strong, probably the key theme through your new book, The God Delusion, which will be out sometime this fall, we think.
Well, actually, it seems to be already out. It looks as though Barnes & Noble have jumped the gun and broken the embargo.
Well, great. We're going to have to get it to...
So it is now in Barnes & Noble. And
Amazon.com, I know,
Amazon
has been taking orders.
Amazon has now followed suit, and so I think it can now be obtained through Amazon as well.
I've debated some of these theists who, as you say, bring up this probability argument. And instead of arguing that God exists, they get up and argue that, well, based upon all these Bayes' theorems and probabilities, we can conclude that there is a high likelihood of probability that there is a God. And so I sometimes say, oh, well, so you're not arguing that he does exist, you're arguing that he probably exists. Will you admit that if there is such a probability that he does, that there is also a possibility that he does not? And they never say that.
Mm.
Because it would imply if there's a probability for, there's also a corresponding probability against. And they never come down and say, well, yes, there is a possibility that he doesn't exist, because they believe by faith.
But, of course, your book is saying that, you know, the probability, of course, is that there is no God.
I want to say something much stronger than what Dan's just said, yes. I mean, I want to say that we can only ever talk about probabilities, but the probability that there is a God is very, very small, for precisely the same reason as the probability that an eye or a hemoglobin molecule could spontaneously exist. It's not impossible, but it's very, very, very improbable indeed. And a God would be even more improbable.
So if we're going to...
So you turn their own guns on them. On them.
And you
their
do
own
that
gun of improbability, you turn them on them.
You do that wonderfully in your books. You take their arguments more seriously than they do and turn that around on them.
That's a nice way to put it, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and then for our listeners who may believe in a God or just aren't so sure, can you elaborate on the improbabilities?
Yes. If you look at the standard creationist argument, it will be something like the eye is too improbable to happen by chance, by luck. Because they think that evolution is a theory of luck, they think that disproves evolution. Evolution is not a theory of luck. It's very much the opposite of a theory of luck. It's a theory that explains how you get improbable things like eyes by slow, gradual degrees. And because it's by slow, gradual degrees, that is the only way that's ever been suggested for generating this high level of improbability. Now, the way they normally finish the argument is to say that because an eye or a flagellum or a hemoglobin molecule is so improbable, it cannot have come about by luck, therefore it must have come about by God. And what they don't get is that God himself has to be even more improbable
exactly.
than the eye or the hemoglobin molecule. And so you cannot use God to get out of that bind. We have here an infinite regress which you cannot use God to terminate. If there is a godlike being in the universe, and it could well be, I mean, it's even possible that the whole of life on this planet has been intelligently designed by some vastly superior alien from outer space. If that is true, which I doubt, but if it were true, then the alien from outer space would himself have had to have evolved by slow, gradual degrees for exactly the same reason, that something so improbable could not suddenly have magicked himself into existence. He would have to have developed by slow, gradual degrees.
And there's your infinite regress right there.
Yeah.
So it's better to stop with what we do know about science rather than invent some imaginary creator.
Yes. I mean, it's certainly much better to do that. And the idea of the intelligent alien is a very unparsimonious idea, but it's not a totally ridiculous idea like God is.
Now, you have a mission, I think, if I can use that term, probably not a good one, to wake people up to the dangers of religion today. And one of the things that you've done is a BBC series that we haven't seen, unfortunately, in this country, called The Root of All Evil.
Oh, not BBC, Channel 4.
Channel 4.
It's the rival company.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
And it was called The Root of All Evil. With a question mark.
Yes.
About religion.
Yes.
And you go around the world, you come to America, and you go to Jerusalem, and you talk with religionists all over. It's a very powerful series. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about it.
We had to go to Iceland in order to see
that's
it.
That's right. it's a two-hour documentary. It was shown on two successive weeks on Channel 4 in Britain in January 2006. And I'm actually doing another one now, which is to be shown in January 2007, which is provisionally called The Rational Inquirer, which is about not religion this time, but all the other kinds of irrationality, like telepathy and homeopathy and water divining and that kind of thing, psychics and psychokinesis and stuff. Anyway, Root of All Evil with a question mark. The question mark was the sole concession I managed to wring out of Channel 4. I actually hated the title Root of All Evil because I don't believe that religion is the root of all evil. Nothing is the root of all anything. But on the other hand, root of quite a lot of evil is not a very catchy title. So they gave me a question mark, which was a rather unsatisfactory compromise. It's in two episodes. In the first episode, I traveled, as you say, to America, to Colorado. I interviewed Pastor Ted Haggard of Colorado Springs, who runs one of these terrifying mega churches with rock music and flashing lights and all the techniques, as I told him, of a Goebbels Nuremberg rally. Then I went to he threw us out. He threw the camera crew and me out of the church and threatened to seize our film.
Makes for good TV.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, the camera wasn't running when he threw us out.
Oh.
We went to Lourdes and looked at the Catholic pilgrims there going to dunk themselves in filthy water. And we went to Jerusalem and talked to the chief mufti, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the chief Muslim there, and an influential Jew, and another man who was a complete, a really dangerously nuts character, who had been a Jew in America. He was an American Jew who'd converted to Islam. And we interviewed him because we thought he would give a sort of, would see both sides of the Jewish-Muslim question, how wrong we were. I mean, he was the most rabid, fanatical Muslim you could possibly imagine. And that scene is, well, he was sort of accusing me of of not dressing my women properly and things like that.
You know what struck me about looking at all those different interviews you did was how absolutely certain each one of those people was and is about the rightness of their views and how wrong everyone else.
That is correct.
Look at their faces, you know.
Yeah. That is faith. I mean, that's what it's about. And they're completely implacable. Nothing would ever move them, and they would admit it. I mean, they would agree.
Certitude in the face of no evidence.
Yes.
And what do you think is the prospects for what is the prospect for enlightening the world? I mean, we seem to be on the verge of a new disenlightenment.
Well, yes, it is certainly tempting to take such a pessimistic view, but I think we've got to keep. I don't like to use the word fighting; it sounds too aggressive. But to keep struggling, I'm actually quite encouraged by the sales figures that I quoted earlier of Sam Harris's and my books. Sam's Letter to a Christian Nation is, I believe, at the moment number 2 in Amazon.com's bestseller list.
Wow.
And my own God Delusion is number 2 in the British Amazon
list. That's wonderful.
Mine's pretty high in the American one as well. So I do think that there's a possible indication that things aren't as bad as we feared, and that although books like Francis Collins and Ann Coulter's also make the bestseller lists, they're not the only ones. I mean, we're doing all right, and maybe there'll be others that will too.
Well, you have been a great champion of free thinking and reason, and we're very appreciative that you made time in your very busy schedule to talk with us today. And we'll have more information for listeners about the God Delusion.
And his speech that he prepared for our convention is online at after 2001.
Yes, The Time to Stand Up can be found at our website, FFRF.org. It's a wonderful speech. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is Annie Laurie Gala for Free Thought Radio here in the studio with Dan Barker. We've just been interviewing Professor Richard Dawkins, and we have the privilege of playing an excerpt from his documentary for Channel 4 in the United Kingdom, which played in January, The Root of All Evil, about religion. So we're going to play a few minutes of the opening, the audio only, of course, the opening of his TV documentary. So please sit back and enjoy.
Of course, the movie is really a beautiful movie to watch as well, but just imagine what you might be seeing here.
There are would-be murderers all around the world who want to kill you and me and themselves because they're motivated by what they think is the highest ideal. Of course, politics are important. Iraq, Palestine, even social deprivation in Bradford. But as we wake up to this huge challenge to our civilized values, don't let's forget the elephant in the room, an elephant called religion. The suicide bomber is convinced that in killing for his God, he will be fast-tracked to a special martyr's heaven. This isn't just a problem of Islam. In this program, I want to examine that dangerous thing that's common to Judaism and Christianity as well. The process of non-thinking called faith. I'm a scientist, and I believe there is a profound contradiction between science and religious belief. There is no well-demonstrated reason to believe in God. And I think the idea of a divine creator belittles the elegant reality of the universe. The 21st century should be an age of reason, yet irrational, militant faith is back on the march. Religious extremism is implicated in the world's most bitter and unending conflicts.
We want the non-Muslims off the lands of Muhammad. We want the kuffar out of it.
America, too, has its own fundamentalists.
The issue for the next generation is going to be the Islamification of Europe.
And in Britain, even as we live in the shadow of holy terror, our government wants to restrict our freedom to criticize religion. Science, we are told, should not tread on the toes of theology. But why should scientists tiptoe respectfully away?
The time has come for people of reason to say enough is enough. Religious faith discourages independent thought, it's divisive, and it's dangerous.
What's going on here is a parade of pilgrims and lords, and Professor Dawkins is walking amongst them in a candlelight procession.
It looks lovely, doesn't it? Inoffensive and gentle. But isn't this the beginning of that slippery slope that leads to young men with rucksack bombs on the tube? If you want to experience the medieval rituals of faith, the candlelight, incense, music, important-sounding dead languages, nobody does it better than the Catholics. At Lourdes, in southern France, the assault on the senses appeals to us not to think, not to doubt, not to probe. And if we can retain our faith against the evidence, in the teeth of reality, the more virtuous we are.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor here with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio, and we've just been talking with evolutionary biologist and atheist Richard Dawkins and listening to a few excerpts from his very powerful documentary called The Root of All Evil about religion. That was a tiny excerpt, and hopefully we'll be able to actually watch this soon in the United States. The answer to this week's disbelief quiz, the question that I asked you was, by act of Congress, In God We Trust has appeared on all U.S. currency in what year? And that answer, it's a trick question, was D, 1957. It was in 1955 that Congress passed a law requiring that In God We Trust appear on all U.S. coins and currency, the first paper currency with the motto that appeared in 1957. That was after the McCarthy era, during the early Cold War, when no congressperson would dare be seen voting against God. In God We Trust had appeared occasionally on a few coins, starting with a 2-cent piece in the 1860s, and that was at the behest of a preacher who wanted to put God on the side of the North during the Civil War. It gradually was on other coins until it was on most coins by the 1940s. But it was not on U.S. currency until the Act of Congress. And also, in 1956, an Act of Congress adopted In God We Trust as the national motto. The original motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of one come many, celebrating plurality and our federal state form of government, still appears on the presidential seal and on some paper currency.
I'm Dan Barker with co-host Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio, produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. And maybe we can talk about a lawsuit that's challenging In God We Trust on a future show as that thing proceeds. Our engineer today has been Brian Turani. Our announcer is Buzz Kemper from Audio for the Arts. This show can also be heard at ffrf.org, where all of our past shows are archived. You can phone the Progressive Hotline at 608-663-7291. If you want to make a comment or ask a question, that's 608-663-7291. Or you can also email us at freethoughtradio@ffrf.org.
We thank Professor Richard Dawkins for joining us today, and thank you for listening to Free Thought Radio. I'll leave you with a warning from one of the bumper stickers that we sell at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Global warning. Religion is divisive.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, www.ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by co-hosts Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
Brotherhood.